So, welcome to you all who are here in Pomaya for this year's 8-week retreat. And also, all throughout the retreat, starting now, I'm holding very much in my heart and mind the people who are listening to my podcasts, whether just slightly delayed from the time here, maybe like one day later, or whether they're listening months later. Time, after all, is relative. And there is a perspective from which all of this is simultaneous anyway. And so, to all of those listening, participating in this retreat, I want to give you a very heartfelt welcome. We've been holding these 8-week retreats since 2010. I don't know that we've, thus far, I've been here a couple of days, I don't know that we've ever been in such a conducive environment. We shall see as the weeks go by, but it's certainly starting off marvelously. And I have to, you know, I'm in Italy now, I use my hands a lot anyway, but just expect it to be a bit overboard, you know, for the next 8 weeks. And this is how you have to talk in this country, and I'm already in the vein. But I just want to thank our very gracious hosts. I've been here for a couple of days and simply cannot imagine greater hospitality than what I've received from the director. I had some long conversation with him. That is Filippo, his wonderful wife, Manu, the resident interpreter here, Fabrizio. So we've just had some really good conversations envisioning how we can be working together in various ways over the coming months, years, who knows. So I think we're off to a very good start. And the material that I'll be sharing with you, I have very deep faith in. You know in gist what we'll be addressing during these 8 weeks. The first is the root text and the commentary by the Penchen Losen Chukyi Kyantsen, regarded variously as the first Penchen Rinpoche. We're going to be looking at it quite closely. And it's his root text commentary on Mahamudra, in which he integrates the continua, or the lineages of the Gelugpa tradition and the Gagyupa tradition. So we'll be spending time on that, and then we'll be focusing on selected chapters from Naked Awareness, which is the kind of addendum of teachings given by Karma Chamen Rinpoche, following the spacious path of freedom. And of course, we taught that last year. So he finished the whole path, and there was a lot more to it than is translated in A Spacious Path to Freedom, because when Gyatso Rinpoche taught me this, he said, well, let's skip the preliminaries, because there are a lot of teachings out there already. Not that they're in any way not important, they're enormously important, but we've covered that, you know? We've covered that many, many times. So now let's go into what is distinctively this union of the Mahamudra and Dzogchen by one of the great lineage holders, the Karma Chamen Rinpoche, and Gyatso Rinpoche himself is a lineage holder from that tradition. And so when I think back to the teachings that I received of the transmission, the explanation, the oral commentary, this was 40 years ago. My Geshe Rabten, one of my principal lamas, with whom I trained quite extensively throughout the 1970s, he taught this to a small group of us in Rikon, in Switzerland. And so Masumo Corona, I think he's around here someplace, not in this room, but he's nearby, he was there, so a number of old Dharma friends were there for those teachings. And it was in that same year that Geshe Rabten really told me I should start teaching. I didn't have much choice in the matter, unless I wanted to just, you know, run away. And he authorized me to teach everything he's taught me. So that's where the lineage, the transmission, the oral commentary comes from. It's from Geshe Rabten for this union of the Gelugpa, or Gandemba, and Gagyu traditions, Mahamudra. So that was 40 years ago, and then it was about 20 years ago that Gyatso Rinpoche taught this text, Naked Awareness, the addendum to the kind of union of Mahamudra and Dzogchen. And he also authorized me to teach everything that he taught me. And so that's where this is coming from. So this, in terms of practices themselves, we'll be focusing really, well, first of all, on bodhicitta, which sets the stage for everything else. And then in terms of the core meditations taught in these texts, we'll be focusing on shamatha, and then vipassana, and then going right into the nature of rigpa. And that's where we'll see the real union of the Mahamudra and Dzogchen traditions. So that's in Naked Awareness. I presume all of you are familiar with the Spacious Path to Freedom, because that really provides kind of the first floor. If this is the second floor, he's assuming you've heard those teachings, that you've assimilated those teachings to some extent. And then having completed the whole path, I don't know of any other text like this. He taught the whole path from the very basics of the preliminaries through every stage, right through the direct crossing over, the leap over, to rainbow body. He finished. And then he went right back again and said, well, I could add a few points. And then that was another 300 pages, where he addressed, he elaborated on some topics that were more lightly touched on, and then simply took a different perspective, and just really added some very, very rich material. So when I first selected these texts to teach during this retreat, I thought I would teach them sequentially. I thought we'd spend maybe 3 weeks or so on the Panchen Rinpoche's root text and commentary, and then go to naked awareness. But as so often happens, very frequently, actually normally, when I arrive someplace to teach, after I've arrived, then I start revising what I'm going to teach. Just, it happens a lot. And that's what happened here too. I've happily had a couple of days of just rest after leading a retreat in Spain, just quiet and then reflection. And then it just became totally obvious that it doesn't really, it's not optimal to teach these two texts purely sequentially, but rather integrate them. And this is something His Holiness Dalai Lama, who is my root Lama, he often does. When he's giving teachings, he'll often take two texts. But by and large, when he does so, he doesn't just teach one and then teach another one. He integrates the two. So he's going back and forth, back and forth. And that's exactly what I intend to do for these two. So that's the gist. What I know all of you have some spiritual practice, otherwise you wouldn't be here. You've already, you know, have a daily practice. You have some background. And I would say with great confidence that whatever your unique background is, because you have different teachers, and all of you, of course, has somewhat of a unique practice, that whatever your practice is that you're already committed to, I'm very confident that the theory and practices that we'll be exploring here will augment, enrich, deepen what you're already doing. It was certainly never imagined that this would be kind of like in competition with your practice. So what's it going to be, your practice, or can I pull you over to my side? Yeah, that's a silly notion. So I have a lot of confidence in that. Because whatever your practice may be, including any school of Buddhism, but outside of that, Christian, contemplative, Hindu, and so forth, shamatha is simply indispensable. And so, of course, we'll include that. And then whatever one's practice might be, to explore the nature of the mind, the mind that we're experiencing every day, but going right down to the ground, through the substrate consciousness, right down to the ground awareness, pristine awareness, that actually has to be central. Finally, sooner or later, this exploration of the very nature of the mind has to be central to any Buddhist practice. Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, Chan, Zen, anything. So in this way, this time we're going to be spending together, I think, is going to be very synthetic in the sense of synthesizing traditions that might, at first glance, or a kind of a superficial examination, seem to be at variance with each other, compatible with each other. I've been tremendously blessed over the last now 45 years to have had really superb teachers in the Theravada tradition and then all four of the schools of Tibetan Buddhism. And I've always been taught. I've never trained under any sectarian teacher. I know they must be out there, but they're not among my teachers. And so all of my teachers have really highlighted the common ground, well, and then being totally relaxed about the distinctive features, the unique features of the Gelugpa tradition, of the Sera Che interpretation of the Gelugpa tradition, you know, and then the Kagyu, Nyingma, Sakya, and so forth, highlighting, delighting in the unique qualities, and then recognizing, you know, there are points of debate where the great masters of these different traditions would be debating with each other. And certainly there is such a thing as wrong views. I mean, one can have clearly misapprehensions of reality. But among these great teachers, really having a false view that would derail you from the path to enlightenment, Longchenpa, Lama Mipa Rinpoche, Tsongkhapa, Kedupje, Gampopa, Garmachame, these are all great beings. So the notion that among them there's going to be a rotten apple, somebody who's really teaching people how to go astray, despite all the debates, and there are a lot of debates. I debated myself, you know, for years when I was receiving my formal monastic training. But those are skillful means. Clearly there are, again, false views, and I might even critique one or two of them on occasion. You'll have no idea what unless you're really intuitive, you know? But that's not going to be the main point. We're here. And so integration, the Gelugpa and the Gagyu, two very powerful traditions, very complementary in many ways, bringing these together. And then we have the Mahamudra and the Dzogchen tradition, the Gagyu and the Nyingma, integrating these. Kamachame Rinpoche, who's a lineage holder for both, he's integrating these. And then we'll find in this text by Penjin Rinpoche a number of citations even from the Sakya Pandita. So the Sakya is brought into the fold as well. So that's how we'll be spending our 8 weeks. And so then in terms of being here now, first of all, I've just noticed Glenn being here. I just want to give a special thanks to Glenn. We would have only about 37 people here were it not for Glenn, because I know exactly what my limitations are in terms of giving weekly interviews, and I maxed out at 36. That's just the way it is, because I can tell you what I'm going to be doing here unless I get sick or something really weird happens. My daily practice is about 9 hours of meditation a day. I do email, I teach, and I sleep. Wow. There's not much going else. I don't want to do anything. I've done this many times. I know how it works out. And once again, I'm in a wonderfully conducive environment. So 36, but we have obviously more than 36 people here, so I'm very happy to have Glenn, trusted Dharma friend, fellow teacher, to be captaining us on our voyage. But there we have not a bad metaphor. And that is, we are, as we speak of crossing the ocean of samsara, we are, in a manner of speaking, poetically, setting out on an 8-week voyage here. And I'm sure all of you, at least for all the people who are resident here, and I know a number of people are auditing, and very welcome to do so, but for everyone here in this retreat physically, who's residential, you all have your own private accommodation. I insist on that for the 8-week retreats. And so we have a balance here. And you know, I'm the balance walla. And so that's going to be a theme that comes up all the time. But here's one of the balances. And it's specifically for these 8-week retreats, more than any other that I teach. And that is, you have your own individual rooms. And we are spending relatively little time together, collectively, out of, you know, let's say 16, 17 hours of waking time each day. This is a small fraction of that. Half an hour plus in the morning. It sometimes runs over, as the old timers know. But basically half an hour. And then in the afternoon, it's going to be an hour and a half, because dinner, I believe, is at 6. And so it's 4:36, and then, basta, we're finished. And then we're off. And so that's a small fraction, 2 hours, maybe maximum 2.5 hours, and that's it, of our time collectively together. Which then, everybody here, you're a sufficiently mature practitioner, otherwise, again, we would not have admitted you, because this puts the whole responsibility of maintaining a very robust, completely dedicated, fully engaged daily practice. That's your responsibility. There are teachers, and very good teachers, who will spend 8 hours a day, but I do that for short retreats, 8 hours a day with the students, and so basically just show up. Just show up in the presence of the teacher, and then the discipline is provided for you. Ding, ding, dong, ding, dong, and you know exactly what to do, right? But here, it's not like that at all. Most of the time, you're on your own, right? And so, but the upside of this is that I have a chance to meet with you individually, which I simply don't. When I'm teaching 8 hours a day, there is no time. Even if it's a small retreat, I still don't have time, because even then I'm trying to meditate 6, 7, 8 hours a day. Because that's what keeps it fresh for me. I never, those of you who've watched me teach over the years, how often have you seen me teach and I kind of look bored? Like, whoa, I have to teach this again. Jeez. All right, well, okay, here we go to this whole thing. It just never happens. It never happens. But I know why, because I'm always coming out of meditation. I teach and go back to meditation. Then it's fresh. And then I get to listen too. I find the teaching quite interesting. Not all the time. I've heard them, some of them before. But sometimes I actually find them quite interesting. And so, but this is leading up to this theme of balance. So on the one hand, for everyone here who has your own private accommodation, then this is your private retreat. And I'm here to facilitate that, support that in my or Glenn's weekly interviews with you, give you personal guidance to really maximize the benefit, the value you can find in this time together. And so we have, I think it's 55 people now, including the auditors, 55 people, the last count. So then we have 55 individual retreats. That's what we're dealing with here, 55 individual retreats. It's as if you've gone off to a cabin in Tuscany and you're hunkering down and just doing your practice, with a bit of help, So on the one hand, that's it. You're responsible for your practice. I'm here simply to help you, on the one hand. But now where's the balance? Well, there's one ship here. It's called the eight-week retreat in Pomaya. We are here collectively. We are here, so there's two things happening. There's one entity called the group of us, singular. We are a group. This group does in the singular. And so we are collective. And we're here to support each other in practice. And bottom line, not in any way to deter from or undermine each other's practice. And so this calls for a collective vision, a collective awareness that this group here has a certain kind of cohesion to it. We have the people in the master's program, and they have their cohesion in their group, and we'll be bumping into each other a little bit, but these are different groups. And so I'd like you to hold these two in mind, that here as part of a fellowship, we're all crew, captain and co-captain, whatever, but we're here together to engage in practices together, to discuss together, to practice. And so this balance of individual retreat, but also collective retreat. And in terms of the collective retreat, there's just a kind of a bottom line, absolute, indispensable, non-negotiable foundation for our interrelationship with each other. And it's very, I don't expect any problems here, but I will say I take very seriously. It is indispensable. And that is on all occasions, without any exception for the next 8 weeks, we treat each other with courtesy and respect. That's it. If you do that, everything's covered. If we think of ethics and we think of nonviolence and compassion, or nonviolence and benevolence, very good. But if we just bring it down a notch, just to ordinary speech, we all know what courtesy is. It's not a mysterious term. And we know what discourteous is. We know what, when it happens to us, we know it very well. And on some occasions, I'm sure we've, been discourteous to others. But not for these 8 weeks. This is bottom line. That courtesy, but also respect, for very good reason. This takes a major sacrifice, a major commitment to take out 8 weeks of a life, devote it purely to Dharma. That's a very respectful thing to do, a respectable thing to do, worthy of respect. And so it's giving respect where respect is due, So that I would ask, and as I would ask it for you amongst each other, from you to me, and you can expect from me to you. This is completely reciprocal. There's no, in this regard, no difference, right? So that's quite clear. So we have ethics. And then we have samadhi, ethics, samadhi, and wisdom. And I'd really quite passionately like to encourage you to raise the bar. To raise the bar, not in terms of your meditative practice when you're formally in meditation, but in between sessions. I'd like to give you a real challenge here. And that is, we know in, just generally speaking, for the human species, but now more specifically for modernity, we know that scientists have studied this, psychologists have studied, and found that about 80% of the time people are caught up in rumination. They're caught up in mind wandering. It's involuntary, obsessive, compulsive kind of thinking that is not related to the reality at hand. And that's about 75-80% of the time. Most of this so-called rumination is unpleasant, and it's a habit. It's just that. It's just a bad habit. Now, if we look into the inner prerequisites for actually achieving shamatha, the outer prerequisites of the environment, covered. Got that one covered. The inner prerequisites, I'm not going to go through all of them, just the last one. If one is serious about really following a path of shamatha and not just practicing shamatha, but developing through the 9 stages, then the final inner prerequisite that is highlighted in the classic literature, which comes from the yogis themselves, is, I know it in Tibetan so well, karasa, drupa la sope nambo yosun pamba. It just rolls off the tongue. It's complete elimination. Pamba means to abandon, to get rid of, to discard, like that, quite clear. Bangba is thoroughly discarding, getting rid of compulsive ideation. This is the rumination, mind wandering, involving desire and so on. Okay? In other words, it's a new baseline. It's a new baseline. And that is in between sessions that we establish a new baseline of inner quiet, settling the inner voice of the mind in its natural state, which is effortless silence. And of course, this is not anti-thought or anti-intellectual at all. It has nothing to do with either of those. It is anti-unhealthy mind, because it's simply not a sign of sanity. Nobody in his right mind would think it's sane, it's healthy, it's really, really good to have a mind that's out of control, keeps on talking and talking and talking, meandering around, blah, 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 80% of the time. And to think while that is a major characteristic of one mind, one is also mentally sound. That's not mentally sound at all. That's kind of like, that's really a problem. But it's so endemic, you know, that it's considered normal. Well, it is normal, but normal sucks. And so that's where we're going to start tonight, is to set, you know, raise the bar, a new benchmark, and just experience what it's like to be at ease and silent and clear. And then when you want to think, think. And when you're finished thinking, like drinking a cup of tea, put it down and don't drink anymore. When you've stopped thinking, then stop. When you want to think creatively, then think creatively. You want to daydream, daydream. You want to reminisce. Reminisce. But these are voluntary acts. And then when you're finished, you put them down and you return to your new baseline. And the baseline is being at ease, inwardly, not only outwardly still, but inwardly still, and clear, cognizant. Now that's healthy, just flat out, let alone Dharma, the path to liberation and all of that. That's an indication of a sound mind, a sane mind, a balanced mind, for starters, right? And so that's what I'd really strongly encourage you. To support that, I'll raise the issue that, again, is not black and white, that is not just kind of hard and fast, but more a matter of principle. And that is, today being Tuesday, let's say Wednesday and Thursday, I'll encourage you to just socialize over meals, get to know each other, learn each other's names as much as you wish to, cultivate a sense of community, you know. So today, Tuesday, so Wednesday and Thursday, all three meals. If you don't want to, that's of course your choice, but I am encouraging you to highlight this aspect of community, that we are here as a group and not just a bunch of individuals staring down at the floor and ignoring everybody around us, right? So that's Wednesday and Thursday. And then Friday. Friday, let's return to silence. But it's silence that is not, I don't think that, you know, people often call it noble silence. I don't think there's anything really noble about it, unless the motivation is noble. It's just you're not talking, so what's the big deal? You know? Noble silence. But let that be your default mode, because we are in retreat. And we know that, I mean, it's perfectly obvious that when we're just chatting, killing time, just, you know, socializing, and just talking about whatever comes up. Oh, did you see the latest headlines? Oh, my mother this, my dad, my blah, 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 blah. It just disperses the mind. It just disperses the attention. And then you have to do all the remedial work to get back to where you were before you went into kind of just chatting. So I would suggest no chatting at all. Just, you know, meaningless, you know, idle gossip. What the world does when there's nothing else to do, they just start talking, you know, or going for entertainment. And so this is a place of no chit-chat and no entertainment. At the same time, a couple of things, and that is sometimes it's just really useful to be able to speak a little bit, because something comes up that needs to be discussed, then discuss. It's like, you know, consciously thinking, then consciously speak, and then stop speaking. You know, when the job is done, stop speaking. And then another point is I've already been exploring a little bit, places to walk in the area. I asked Filippo, the director here, can you suggest any good places to walk? And he went, where is not a nice place? What's wrong with everything? And so I've already found my little, I'm a person of routine. When I'm in retreat, I just really like routine. I don't need anything new. I just like to go deeper into a nice pattern, and I've already found it. But if on occasion you have a Dharma friend here, it could be just a friend, it could be a spouse, it could be a new friend, anybody. And you feel, with this mutual consent, that you just feel that, you know, you'd like to go for a walk, and that would be more meaningful for your practice than to maintain strict silence. And go for it. Go for it. Nobody's going to be monitoring, nobody judging. So if I'm out walking and I see the two of you talking, that's your business. We're all adults here, and we're not here just to follow rules. So I will kind of just, number one, I'm not going to give much thought to it because I'm just going to be doing my practice. But if I give any thought to it, I'm going to simply assume, well, you're probably talking about something very meaningful. Because you don't need to travel all the way here to waste time. Waste time at home, it's easy. And it's free. So there's the balance. And then, oh yes, so we have, actually, certainly for all of the people who are resident, and then it's your call for those who are auditing, I would really ask you, before, let's say tomorrow, before tomorrow evening, since you will be talking over meals, to find a buddy, okay? Buddy system. We do have certain commitments to coming to the retreat like this, and that is we tend to be kind of a focus. Anybody who knows me, punctuality is, to my mind, not an indication of being uptight, but an indication of courtesy. And everybody was here, so that was good. I was the last person in, and I think I was 1 minute early by my watch. And so punctuality, I really would ask that, always for each of the sessions. But then if you get a cold or some emergency comes up, just something, it's your call, or you simply can't make it, you know, that can happen. Occasionally it does happen. Then I'm simply asking, let your buddy know. I won't be able to come to the afternoon session. I've just heard of a major family crisis and they need me to speak with them. That's one time. My father just had something. My father just had an accident. So I needed to be on call, even though I'm 8,000 miles away, and just to be aware, to be engaged. And so that happens. But let your buddy know. If you get sick and you're not able to come, let your buddy know. We want to make sure that if anyone gets injured, you fall or something like that, or you get sick, let your buddy know. We all, very much including myself, we want to know that you're being taken care of. They have very good medical system here. I had my teeth fixed here when I was in Florence last year. So, but you know, medicine's fine. So we just want to make sure that you're being taken care of, and maybe the sangha can take care of you. Maybe your buddy can take care of you, but we want no one to feel overlooked, as if nobody cares about you, because people do care about you, and we'd like you to know that. Okay. So please find a buddy, your choice, of course. So, those are the major points. I think that's pretty much it. Okay, on that note then, please find a comfortable position. I'd like to do the expected. Sometimes it's good not to be surprised. I'd like to have a 24-minute session. In all sessions, we have a fair amount, not a whole lot, but back there in the back, I see there's floor space. Some of you have already carved out your turf. But anytime there's space here as well. I see two of those blue cushions in a length, they would make a very nice platform if you want to go supine. And I would strongly encourage you soon, like starting tonight, to learn how to meditate in the supine position. I've been appreciative of it for a very long time, and my appreciation of that as an alternate to sitting in the formal posture is only growing. And so you don't need to do it here, of course, sit in whatever or meditate in whatever posture is most conducive, but I'd really strongly encourage you, if not here, then in between sessions, in your own room, really learn how to meditate in the supine position. There are so many advantages to it, and I'll probably talk about them over the next several weeks. But at any time, in any of the sessions here, if you'd like to be supine, I still there's still floor space, and so you're always welcome to do that. You never need to ask, and we simply ask that if you're more or less here, that your feet are pointing away from the objects of refuge here. Simply a basic kind of Buddhist courtesy. And besides that, let's go right in. So the sessions will all be 24 minutes, one gattaka, taught by, I think it was Kamala Shila, is a good starting point. bringing forth your most meaningful motivation for this entire retreat. And as an expression of loving kindness for yourself, let the locus of your attention, your awareness, descend from the head right down to the ground. If you're sitting on a chair, down to the ground. If you're sitting cross-legged or in the supine position, right down to the ground. Then, like a fragrance filling a room, let your awareness fill the entire space of the body. Be mindfully aware of the tactile sensations arising throughout the entire space. Set your body at ease in a posture of relaxation, of comfort, of looseness. If you feel areas in the body that feel tight, as you breathe in, gently attend or focus your awareness on these areas. And as you breathe out, relax deeply, surrendering the muscles to gravity, loosening up, softening with every out-breath. Bring your awareness to the face. Soften the muscles around the mouth, the jaws. The forehead, which often contracts and tightens in times of anxiety, stress, and so on. Let your forehead feel spacious, open, relaxed. Let there be a spaciousness between the eyebrows. Soften all the muscles around the eyes. And soften the eyes themselves. Insofar as your body does feel relaxed and comfortable, for the brief duration of this 24-minute session, you should find it quite easy to remain still, with no unnecessary fidgeting, just the movement of the breath. Whether you're sitting or lying, let your spine be straight. If you're sitting, of course, it is erect. You slightly raise the sternum, keeping the abdominal muscles loose and relaxed, so that when the breath flows in, you feel the belly expand and fall back as you breathe out. The same in the supine position. You don't raise the sternum, but in a posture of utter relaxation, feel the sensations of the breath go down to the belly, expanding as you inhale, falling back as you exhale. In this way, we settle the body in its natural state, a state of dynamic equilibrium, in which the body is relaxed, still, and vigilant. We settle the speech in its natural state, which is one of effortless silence, the outer speech. For the outer speech, this is easy. You've already accomplished it. But such silence with regards to the speech of the mind, of course, is a greater challenge. Not forcefully suppressing thought, but so setting the body-mind at ease that the flow of obsessive compulsive ideation subsides. And the key to this is the breath, settling the respiration in its natural rhythm, effortless and unimpeded. The key here is the out-breath. Take advantage of every out-breath, during and between sessions, of a time to release the breath all the way to the end, holding nothing in reserve. This does not entail pushing the breath out or expelling it, but rather letting it flow out effortlessly, all the way to the end. The very end of exhalation here is critical, because if you mentally talk through it, chit-chat, rumination, you'll miss it. The mind needs to be quiet and attentive, relaxing deeply. So you fully exhaled, and as you exhale, with each out-breath, relax the body more and more deeply. With each exhalation, release the breath all the way to the end. And with each exhalation, release any thoughts or memories that may have come to mind. Just let them vanish right back into the space of the mind from which they arose, returning to silence, returning to the present moment. A threefold release of body, breath, and mind with every exhalation. Once you fully release the breath, do nothing to prevent the next breath from flowing in, but nothing to help it flow in either. Let the breath flow in effortlessly, with no mental effort. And whether it's deep or shallow, fast or slow, do not intervene, do not try to regulate or influence the flow of the breath in any way. Release all control. And breathe in and out egolessly. And finally, we settle the mind in its natural state by first of all setting the mind at ease. This takes a lot of preparation to succeed in that, because it entails releasing for the time being all concerns, hopes, and fears about the future and the past, which so preoccupy our minds. Releasing it all and allowing yourself the leisure and the opportunity rest in the present moment, free of grasping, free of desire and aversion. And when the awareness is free, or insofar as the awareness is free of grasping, it is naturally still. Still like an unflickering candle flame, it is relaxed, still, and clear. Rest in that stillness and clarity of your own awareness. simply rest your awareness in its own place without extending it or directing it to any object, either sensory or mental. Just let your awareness rest. Resting in its own place, holding its own ground. Sustain the flow of mindful presence without distraction, without grasping. Without distraction means without allowing your awareness to be drawn outwards to any appearances, sensory or mental. Remaining still. And without grasping means without identifying with any subjective mental process such as thinking, desiring, imagining, and so on. Let thoughts, images, memories come and go. Like clouds passing across the sky. But let your awareness remain still and relaxed. The central theme of our meditation practice is throughout all of our time together will be the awareness of stillness and motion. The stillness of your own awareness in the midst of the motion of sensations throughout the body, activities of the mind, and appearances from the surrounding environment. The world is in motion, but let your awareness be still. Oh, naso. So within the Buddhist context, certainly in the comparative teachings I've received over the last 45 years, the phrase chittu jawe dulja comes up a fair amount. And the meaning of that is when teaching is a given, who is the intended audience? That is, who are they for? It's like medicine. You don't just say, I got medicine, who wants some? But this is a particular type of medicine for people with a particular type of ailment. It's not generic, right? And so for the teachings here, I'll make an informed speculation that these teachings, the root text and commentary by the Pinchen Rinpoche, and these teachings by Karmachame Rinpoche, both from the 17th century, by the way, they were contemporaries. The Pinchen Lama being the guru of both the 4th and the 5th Dalai Lamas, so great scholar, great adept. Karmachame Rinpoche, renowned in the Gagyu and the Nyingma traditions, again a man of tremendous erudition and very deep realization. And so, why were they giving these teachings? Because there's such a wide bandwidth of teachings one might give for general audiences, specific audiences. There's this sort of lekka, the Nagarjuna's teaching, that was specifically intended for a king, right? So if you're a king, those are for you. Or if you'd like to be a king. But I'm going to make an informed speculation that for these two authors, that they gave these teachings, which are clearly, you know, how do we say, very deep teachings. They were giving these teachings for people who are very intent on reaching the path to enlightenment and proceeding along it. Not simply people who want to practice Dharma. You don't need this if you want to practice Dharma. There's all kinds of Dharma you can practice without doing any of this, and have a very good Dharma practice as well. Gautama himself didn't leave home at the age of 29 to practice Dharma. He could have been a very good king, father, husband, and so forth at home. He didn't need to leave. Geshe Rabdin, my teacher, one of my principal teachers, again, he's the one from whom I received the lineage for the Pinchen Rinpoche's text. He left home at the age of 19, not to practice Dharma. He had a very loving father. He had a very nice situation back in Kham. He could have been a good cowboy, because that's what he was, a ranch hand. He could have run the ranch and been a very good, very virtuous layperson. What's wrong with that? Well, for some people, it's just not enough. Looking for greater meaning, looking for a path. And by this, I mean something very specific, but very, very characteristically Buddhist. When we speak of path, we're referring to a mode of practice which includes a way of viewing reality, a shifting one's priorities, a way of conducting oneself throughout one's daily activities, and then specifically, like the cutting edge of the knife, is your meditative practice. This matrix that gives rise to irreversible transformation and liberation. That's a path. There's a lot of Dharma one can practice that will propel you to a really nice place for a while in samsara, a very fortunate human rebirth or deva rebirth and so forth, and then the karma that propelled you there runs out and then you just fall back. No. But a path suggests within a context of one life that you're really seeing some evolution, some transformation, some growth, maturation, that you're not spinning your wheels, you're not just doing repeat performances. But there's something really taking place. And that's not only from in the context of one life, but again from lifetime to lifetime. But a path means not only you're getting someplace, you're progressing, but a path to reach the path, lam topa, to reach the path, means you've set out in such a way, with such depth and commitment, that you will not fall back. So I was first introduced to this whole notion, like 1971 or two, by Geshe Ngawang Taiki, the first Lama from whom I received quite extensive teachings. And as soon as I heard about it, it just kind of really ignited my mind. That I thought, well, there's the meaning of life. I was only 22 or so at the time, so I wasn't too old. And I was thinking, well, that's it. And he said, Geshe Ngawang Taiki said, you know, speaking to people of my generation, we were all young back then, there weren't anybody, you know, over the hill like 30 years old. You know, nobody was that old, you know. We are all young. And he said, you know, when you're starting young like this, then really achieve bodhicitta in this lifetime. I mean, otherwise you've wasted your life, you know. And that is within the Mahayana context. that really is the key, essential ingredient that determines have you reached the path or not. And I'm referring in classic Buddhist teachings that some people, I suppose, treat more academically, theoretically, a matter to debate about and talk about and then move on to the next topic. That's just not the way Gisheng Amantage introduced us to it. This Abhisamaya Alankara, Upadesha Shastra. Upadesha is Menga. Menga is pith instructions. These were pith instructions that Maitreya gave to a Sangha, and the Sangha is passed on, and we have it now 1,500 years later. It's often treated as an academic, something you spend the years on, and you debate, and you understand, and then you teach. I don't think that was ever the intention, that this is just kind of the academic side, whereas you have the pith instructions, the meditation that's over in Lamrim, over in Dzogchen, or something like that. I don't think so. In fact, I think that whole demarcation is false. I really do. I think all the teachings that many people regard as theoretical are all entirely intended for practice. That is Tsongkhapa's view. I will say that with total confidence. He was not just saying, well, do all the intellectual stuff because, yeah, isn't intellectual stuff so much fun? But then we'll get to meditation later. No way. Absolutely contrary to his whole approach. And so within this context, we have these five paths, path of accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, and then no more training. And this is within the Mahayana context, the Mahayana path of accumulation. It comes in the initial, the medium, and the great stage. And you reach the small stage, the initial stage of the Mahayana path of accumulation. You have entered that path. When bodhicitta arises effortlessly, spontaneously, your mind is bodhicitta. And it flares up, it manifests with just the slightest catalyst. And it just comes up. You don't have to keep on pumping away at it, you know, generating, pushing. You have cultivated, and so there comes a point where it just now, you're still cultivating, but it arises effortlessly. It's called Juma Mayan Bechanchukasem, uncontrived, unmodified, unfabricated, naturally arising, spontaneously arising bodhicitta. And when that arises, you are now a bodhisattva. That's when the other bodhisattvas throw a party. We've got another member of the club, you know, the bodhisattva fraternity, maternity, sorority, whatever. That's when it happens. And according to the lineage, now there's some debate here. I respect the debate. But in terms of the teachings I've received from Geshe Antage, from Geshe Rabten, from Genlam Rinpa and others, for bodhicitta to arise in that way, we can all cultivate it. Starting now, we can cultivate it. But to go so deep that it's arising spontaneously like that, in terms of this lineage that I've received, for that to occur, you have to have a very balanced mind. You have to have a superb quality of mental balance. In fact, the five obscurations, you remember them? Ill will, sensual craving for hedonia, ill will, laxity and dullness, excitation and anxiety, afflictive uncertainty. You'll get very familiar with those if you're not already. Those should be subdued. Because the Buddha himself said, I love quoting this because it's so important, and I don't hear many people talking about this, is the Buddha himself said, as long as your mind is still under the influence of those five obscurations, you should consider yourself to be indebted, but the kind of bad kind of debt that you don't know how to pay off, that's bad debt. You should consider yourself indebted. And then, sick, consider yourself ill. Third, you should consider yourself in bondage. No? Ankles. And enslaved. And lost in a desert track. So just, you know, for a 15-second, 30-second visualization exercise, imagine yourself overwhelmed by debt you can't possibly pay off. You're sick as a dog. You've got leg irons and handcuffs on. Somebody just bought you. They've sold you into the slave market. But then they popped you in a helicopter and dropped you in the middle of Sahara and said, good luck. That's how the Buddha characterized the mind that is still under the domination of the five obscurations. So that's what he said. What do you think with a mind like that, what do you think your chances are of developing spontaneously arising effortless bodhicitta and being a bodhisattva with those five qualities? A bodhisattva who is deep in debt, sick, in bondage, enslaved, and lost in a desert track. Oh, but a bodhisattva too. You know, it actually doesn't make any sense. Right. So how do you get rid of the five obscurations? Shamatha. You don't eradicate them, but you do enough to make them go dormant. And so, who are the Chitta Jave Dulja, the the students, the practitioners for whom these teachings are intended, people who have a passionate commitment to reaching the path, and this means to achieve shamatha, to achieve bodhicitta, that enters the path. And if you'd like to seal your entrance into the path so it's irreversible, you'll never be a non-bodhisattva. You'll either be a bodhisattva or a Buddha, but you'll be nothing else. From now on, you'll always be a bodhisattva until you're a Buddha, with no exceptions. You'll never fall back. Then you need to seal that bodhicitta, supported by shamatha. You need to seal it, protect it, like armor, with insight, with wisdom, vipassana. And then you move on to the second stage of the Mahayana path accumulation. And now you can take a little bit of a breather. Like, whoa. Whew, you know? So this doesn't mean that, you know, if one has great inspiration, aspiration, commitment to do so, that as soon as the retreat's over, you'll necessarily be going off into long-term retreat. Some of you have that opportunity. It's fantastic. Not everyone does. I don't. I have more commitments this year, so I cannot simply go off into a solitary retreat. But it should be in mind that when the time is ripe, to go off and achieve shamatha, and just watch when it's ripe. Maintain the motivation. Call for blessings. Call for all the conducive circumstances coming together, inwardly and outwardly. But have it in mind. Have it in mind. And shamatha, in the same breath, shamatha for the sake of really accomplishing bodhicitta, for the sake of deepening wisdom, for the sake of irreversibly setting out on the path, for the sake of achieving perfect enlightenment, for the sake of serving all sentient beings. And then breath by breath, your practice is tremendously meaningful. Ordinary inhalation, exhalation, that type of motivation, it moves mountains. So, I'm retirement age. I could be collecting Social Security now. I could be just sitting in my meditation hut and saying, listen to the podcast, or I'll stay here and teach by Skype, but don't come. I have my little meditation hut in Santa Barbara. I could do that. I'm not for the time being. But the inspiration that which keeps me still in motion, my mouth in motion, is to do all I can to help people reach the path. There are many really outstanding Dharma teachers, Christian, Buddhist, Theravada, Mahayana, and so forth. Really good. There's no dearth. There are many, many good teachers. A lot of really good Dharma. But my own teacher, starting with Geshe Ngan Taige, and then Geshe Rabdin, and then His Holiness, and Gyatso Rinpoche and Gyalam Rinpa, they've really, over the last, again, all these years, and the teachings I've received from them, and then there's nothing special about me, I'm just telling what I receive, they keep on coming back to the path, again and again and again and again. That's what the teachings are for, to reach the path and proceed along the path. So that's why I'm still teaching. Because to get that type of momentum up, and that kind of clarity of the practice, theoretically and then both, you know, meditatively as well, it is helpful to have an actual teacher and not simply listen to podcasts or even by Skype. Be actually the person. It can be helpful. I know because I've received that kind of guidance myself. And I sought out my teacher, Gyatso Rinpoche, just a couple of weeks ago. I had some core question for him. He answered it unequivocally. And I wanted to be with him. I could have just called him up and said, oh, please ask his attendant, please ask him this question and get back to me. I wanted to hear it from his lips. You know, it's my question. So there's no substitute. So that's that. So I welcome everybody who's listening by way of the podcast. And so we'll continue tomorrow. We'll start in the mornings, of course, we just have guided meditation. In the afternoons, then there'll be again starting meditation, and then we'll start going into the texts. And so what we'll be doing now for people listening by podcasts or watching by podcast is we're now, I'd just like to invite everybody to introduce themselves. So there's no need to record this. If you want to record it, you can, but this will not go into the podcast. There's no need. So that's the end of the session for tonight for people listening by podcast. I'll join you again tomorrow. Now, it's already past 8. So what I'd like to do is, because this is just kind of extremely introductory to introductory. But I like to do this on the first night, and that is just sweep across and invite all of you just to tell your first name, maybe where you're from, and maybe a snippet, tiny little bit about your Dharma background. But try to keep it under a minute. Under a minute. Because this is just, you know, this is complete introductory. You'll have time tomorrow morning and afternoon and evening, the next day morning, afternoon and evening, and then we're going to have discussion periods every day. And then we'll get to know each other that way. But just as a brief one, I'd like to hear your name, and I'm going to call on you, and just, but really succinct, because it would be nice to be out of here by 9 o'clock or so. So I'm just going to sweep left to right, and whether I know you, some of you I've never met, some of you I've known for years, but each time I point to you, I'm going to not say your name. I'm just going to say, you over there, and I'm sure I've met you someplace, and just, you know, say your name. All right, if we may begin with you, please. I'm just going to...